She was tempted to ask, but opted to keep quiet. All that mattered was Garrett's safety. Crowley wrapped up the bizarre pep rally, and his gang dashed to their trucks. He took off his cowboy hat, wiped the sweat from his brow with a handkerchief, and looked right at Lacey.
I know what you think about me, and I know why.
Crowley returned the hat to his head.
I ain't claiming to be an angel, but I am loyal, and my loyalty lies to this empire. And I don't mean the Kaisers, neither. I'm talking about our people, not these damn carpetbaggers.
For the first time in her life, Lacey understood what others saw in Crowley. In a world of dirty players, he was one of their own, a native son. She didn't like him any more for it, but she saw his worth. Sometimes you need a lawman who's a little on the dirty side.
Okay, Sheriff, what's your plan?
Lacey asked.
Crowley took a step back. I want y'all to hop in with me. Talon guards will be less likely to start shooting if they see an official vehicle coming in, lights flashing.
He winced as he added,
don't mean they won't, but it might buy us a second or two.
A million thoughts raced through Lacey's mind, and at the forefront was her children. But neither Crowley nor Vicky was the type to put themselves in too great a risk. The duo were masters of self-preservation, which meant they were confident in their success. Crowley flashed his campaign poster smile.
You in? You out?
Lacey thought back to her mother's advice from earlier. When it comes to love, never ever leave anything on the table. That's when she made the decision that she was all in. Clearing her mind of anything else, she grabbed the handle, threw open the door, and marched to Crowley's truck, with the girls behind her, in lockstep. 56. Smitty hacked and coughed with nearly every breath of air he pulled into his lungs. But it wasn't the decades of puffing on Winston's that was tormenting him this time. It was the acrid fumes that were blowing through the canyon. With all the dry kindling, the flames had no buffer. Moving bush to bush, tree to tree, devouring the tall tufts of brittle prairie grass as it moved toward him. Returning to the exact spot he'd left his daughter, Smitty cupped his hand and put it beside his mouth.
Savannah! Savannah!
He turned in circles, trying like hell to keep his watering eyes open, given the burn of the swirling smoke.
Just walk to my voice, darling girl. I'll find you.
Smitty waited a few seconds but heard nothing but the roar of the fire. Pushing through the thick mesquite, he was scratched by the thorns. But he made no effort to avoid the barbs. The terror of losing his daughter far superseded the pain of the scrapes and gashes.
Savannah! Savannah, just call out to me, please!
Smitty had just taken the swipe of a branch across the bridge of his nose when an exposed root caught the toe of his boot and he stumbled, face first to the ground. With his hands bloody and stinging, he brushed off the shards of rock embedded in his palms. He was struggling to his feet when he heard the faint voice call out, Daddy. Almost too afraid to believe she was there, Smitty looked up to find Savannah curled in a ball beneath an overhang in the cliff, a little pocket of fresh air. Asadi's cave. Smitty sprinted to Savannah, pulled her into his arms, hugged her tight.
You okay, darling girl? You okay?
Smitty let loose and looked her over.
You hurt?
Savannah shook her head.
No, Daddy. I'm all right. But I can't hardly breathe.
Me neither, baby.
Smitty looked around. We gotta get up above this smoke. He took her by the hand and led her to the side of the canyon, finding out it was too steep to climb. Only way they were getting out of there was to turn around and head toward the flames. Asadi kept looking back at Tony to make sure he and Ringo were still following behind. Good news was that they'd outrun the truck that was chasing them. Bad news was, there was no turning back. The flames, leaping from the canyon, had moved out onto the plains, and the wind was pushing the fire in their direction. It looked as if clouds from the sky had fallen down to earth. Feeling safe for the moment, Asadi pulled Skip's reins and eased into a walk. In a matter of seconds, Tony was beside them. Although he was pale and his eyelids heavy, the deputy held on tight to the saddle horn to keep himself righted. Suddenly, the Talon pickup roared through the mesquite and out into the open pasture. Uncertain of their own fate, Asadi looked to Tony for answers. And, as if on cue, he pulled the pistol from his holster, spurred Ringo into a run, and charged the truck, head on. 57. Tripp kept his eyes on his scope, panning the open-air ledge for Garrett and Kim. Given his limited view, he couldn't see beyond the walls to either side of the open bay door, but assumed they'd made it out alive. Only thing left was a pile of dead bodies. As it turned out, Tripp's hasty climb to the top of the cooling tower had been an exhausting but worthwhile endeavor. He was just about to check the blind spot at his six when a gunman ran out into the courtyard below. He moved a few feet down the catwalk and repositioned above the railing to get a better angle on his target. It took only a second to realize that it was the silver-haired man in the room with Garrett and Kim, the one who'd been doing all that talking. Tripp rested the crosshairs on his head and eased his finger forward to take the shot. He was pulling the trigger when an explosion came from behind and his shot went high. Tripp dropped the TX-10, jerked the SIG from his holster, and fired wildly at the door. As the rifle barrel swung around the edge and opened up full auto, Tripp sprinted for cover behind a rusted-out motor. Raising his head once taught him not to do it twice. Garrett threw his back to the wall and looked to Kim, who was on the other side of the threshold with her rifle at the ready. She eased out for a peek, but made it no further than a couple of inches when the doorframe was blasted to kindling. In her hasty retreat for cover, Garrett hung his Bren around the corner to return fire, but immediately regretted it. A flurry of rounds screamed through the door, ripping everything in the storeroom to shreds. With Orlov's men regrouped and rearmed, it wouldn't be long before they rushed en masse. Garrett was formulating a plan B when a hissing cylinder flew through the doorway and slid across the concrete until it clacked against the back wall. When glass shattered from side windows and two more canisters of tear gas rolled across the floor, Garrett knew they had only two options left: stay there and suffocate, or go outside to face a maelstrom of lead. Asadi leaned forward and spurred Skip into a run behind Tony, but he could barely keep up with the fierce Palomino. The Wild West deputy was no longer hanging on for dear life. He was riding tall in the saddle, reins gripped in the left hand, and his pistol in the right. Only yards from a head-on collision with the Talon pickup racing toward them, Tony aimed and fired, pockmarking the windshield. He missed colliding with the truck by only inches, slowed Ringo to a trot, then lined up again. Tony spurred the gelding into another charge, aimed his pistol, and fired at the gunman in the back of the truck. He had just dropped the guard when an enemy round landed and knocked him from the saddle. Asadi guided Skip in Tony's direction, then immediately the gunmen turned their sights on him. With rounds zipping overhead, he prodded his buckskin harder. He had just reached his friend when a shooter in the truck bed took aim and shot. Flinching in anticipation, Asadi looked up to find the source of the thundering noise that rose over the gunfire. As Ike moved his helicopter into position ahead of the Talon pickup, he spoke to his door gunners over the intercom.
"You own 'em?" "I'm own 'em," Butch answered back.
Ike gave his bird some left pedal, opening the left side of the Hughes to the scene playing out about 200 feet ahead. Both shooters opened fire, Butch with his Marlin and Kate with her deer rifle, hitting their targets as the chopper blasted past the truck. One shot, one kill. The old codgers were as cool under pressure as any operators Ike had ever carried into battle. While the three in the truck bed were out of commission, the two in the cab were still alive and ready to fight. They filed out of the vehicle and fired up at them, full auto. Ike yanked the collective to get a little lift and pushed the stick left to loop back around. He'd gone easy on his door gunners the first round, but kicked it up over 80 miles an hour to make his bird a difficult target. Coming in hot over the pickup, Ike gave it some left pedal again to open up the shot and let his shooters go to work. Kate got her target, but Butch missed. It must have been a close one, though, because the last gunman ran back to the truck, jumped inside, and gunned it. His wheels kicked up a dust trail as he tore away from there, like a bat out of hell. Not wanting to tangle with the bastard again, Ike looped around, brought his helo low, right over the cab. Neither Butch nor Kate were thrifty with ammo, shooting round after round until the truck rolled to a stop. Ike pushed the stick right and circled back for Sanchez and the boy. Figuring Butch wouldn't leave his horses, he had to ask.
"With that fire headed this way, I'm thinking you won't be leaving your animals."
"Not on your life, son."
Butch turned and pointed to the ground.
Drop me right here and I'll get them out through the backside of the ranch. I know a shortcut.
Kate piped up from the back.
Coming with you, Butch.
No, you ain't. Need someone here to doctor on Sanchez and look after a Saudi.
I ain't no damn nursemaid, Kate shouted back. And that boy can look after himself. Them horses can't. And they're in a hell of a lot of trouble unless we get them out of here.
Ike hated the idea of leaving Butch and Kate behind, but he knew she was right. Circling around and landing, Butch and Kate jumped out and dragged Sanchez on board. Once the deputy was secured in back, the duo sprinted to the horses. Asadi jumped into the passenger seat, donned the headphones like an old pro, and turned to Ike.
We got get going.
It wasn't the time nor the place, but Ike had to smile. The kid was all business, just like Garrett. He gave a salute, pulled the collective, and gave it some right pedal, rocketing toward the hospital in what he suspected would be a vain attempt to save Sanchez's life. 58. Smitty determined that he could go no further back up the canyon. The smoke was too thick, and the heat too blistering. He lifted his daughter up and threw her over his shoulder. Finding the best path up the wall, Smitty rose one miserable step after the other. With something between the sheer will to survive and the hand of God at his back, he made it up top and over the edge, exhausted after having lost two steps in the crumbling sand for every one that had caught hold. Once secured over the ledge, he eased Savannah to the ground, then leaned over and retched. Between the burning heat, the smoke in his lungs, and the exertion of the climb, he was all but spent. Savannah moved to him and massaged his back.
You okay, Daddy?
Smitty nodded, unable to speak at first. Then he turned and drew her close for a hug. He looked her over and cleared his throat of the smoke.
I know you're tired, sweetheart, but we gotta keep going. We gotta run, okay?
Then Smitty looked around and realized there was nowhere to go. The wildfire had surrounded them, and it was closing in fast. Determined not to let her see his panic, Smitty rose, said a quick prayer, and searched for a savior. And in the briefest of moments, the smoke cleared, revealing Big Yeller not 40 yards away at the canyon's edge. Grabbing Savannah by the hand, he dragged her in a near sprint to the giant iron bulldozer, through the flames, across that charred ground that scorched his feet. With Savannah screaming in pain, he swung her into his arms as he sprinted the last 20 yards, then tore up the steps to the cab, careful not to touch the burning handrail. Using his sleeve to click the button and open the door, he placed Savannah inside and threw himself into the driver's seat. Fortunately, the diesel motor was still running and the air conditioner blasting, providing a little cold air to keep the controls from burning his hands. Smitty put the dozer in reverse and backed it from the canyon's edge at full throttle. With machinery in motion, he grabbed his sack lunch and dumped out all the contents to the floor. He snatched up the 24-ounce black can of Monster energy drink, popped the top, and thrust it at Savannah, who drained half of the contents before giving it back. After a few big swallows, Smitty poured some into his cupped hand and rubbed it on Savannah's face, wiping the smoke from her eyes. He had no plan to speak of, other than to get the hell out of there. But with smoke and flames already rising over the steel tracks, it was only a matter of time before the fire engulfed the dozer and swallowed them whole. Lacey watched in the rearview mirror from the passenger side of Crowley's F-250 as the Mescalero posse peeled away and went in a separate direction. They were nearing the desolate ground surrounding the carbon black plant when the sheriff jammed his foot on the gas as he tore off the county road and headed down the access lane to the entrance. At first glance, the facility looked deserted. The front gate was chained and padlocked shut, a fact that didn't seem to faze Crowley. He mashed the accelerator to the floor, driving the power-stroke turbo diesel engine into a vicious snarl. Turning back to Vicky, who looked unusually calm given the circumstance, Lacey had to ask,
"There is a plan, right?"
A very anxious-looking Crystal, who was sitting next to Vicky, looked ready to burst.
"What are we doing?"
"Don't worry."
Vicky had that look, the one bordering somewhere between confident and cocky. "The sheriff and his men have it all under control." Before Lacey could even ask, Crowley shouted a warning.
"Hold on tight. We're going in."
No sooner had Lacey grabbed onto the handle and braced herself than the sheriff flicked on his lights, aimed his grill guard at the center of the chain link entrance, and busted through the gate like it wasn't even there. They were just inside the compound when a half dozen gunmen in the courtyard turned their weapons on them and fired. Crowley slammed his boot on the brakes and the Ford skidded to a halt.
Get down! Get down!
Lacey ducked below the dashboard and looked up as the sheriff threw the vehicle in park. He grabbed his AR-15 from the console, yanked the driver's side door handle, and jumped out. Taking cover behind the hood, he blasted his rifle at the Talon gunman. Lacey was tempted to raise for a peek over the dash when a thunk, 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 thunk of bullets sinking into the truck hood and the intermittent ping of lead hitting the grill forced her to reconsider. The salvo raked along the passenger side, shattering the front and back windows and ripping a string of holes through the roof. Lacey yelled to Vicky over the rapid-fire bang of Crowley's gun.
What do we do now?
Vicky had just started to answer when another volley drilled the passenger door by Lacey's head. Vicky yelled back,
I don't know, but this isn't it.
Lacey had just looked to Crowley again when she saw him crouch low, put the rifle to his shoulder, and race toward the action. Assuming it was clear to rise, she poked her head above the door and surveyed the courtyard. The shooters were now gone, and it was clear by the fading echo of gunfire that the fight had moved further into the plant's interior. As Lacey eased into the driver's seat, Vicky moved from the back, clambering over the console into the passenger's seat. Turning in every direction, Lacey searched for a way out. She had just spotted the entrance when several rounds thunked into the hood. Lacey threw the truck in drive, mashed the gas, and aimed for the nearest building to take cover on the other side. It was only 30 yards, but enough time for the Talon guards to shoot out her front and back tires on the right, dashing any hopes of a getaway. Both she and Vicky followed Crystal's lead, fleeing the exposed pickup and sprinting for cover inside the front door of the main office. The plant was in complete war zone chaos, with an unceasing clatter of shooting from men darting from building to building in a tit-for-tat exchange. And for the first time ever, Lacey prayed that Sheriff Crowley was on the winning side. 59. Garrett jammed his nose and mouth into the crook of his left arm and aimed the Bren rifle with his right. Unable to stand the tear gas a moment more, he burst through the doorway with Kim in tow, wincing in anticipation of the hail of lead that was no doubt sure to come. But to his shock and subsequent joy, the courtyard was abandoned, and his GMC waiting right where he'd left it, albeit full of bullet holes and the windows busted out. Kim eased up beside him, rifle at the ready.
What happened? Where'd they go?
As the knock of heavy gunfire echoed through the plant, Garrett turned his Bren and aimed, but found no immediate threat.
Someone saved our asses. That's what happened. He lowered his weapon and turned to Kim. This has Mario Contreras written all over it.
Couldn't agree more. Kim looked in the direction of the shooting, but as far as I know, he and the team are still in Virginia.
Garrett tilted his head toward his GMC.
Truck looks pretty ugly, but I think it's still running. You need to get to a hospital.
Kim gave a shake of the head.
Not leaving without you.
Garrett wasn't sure she understood how bad she was injured.
Look, Tripp is still out there, and I aim to find him.
Then I'll help.
Kim, we got a little love for someone out there, but we're going to need more guns in the fight to finish these guys off. There's a highway patrol depot in town. Get there quick as you can, and tell them we need every man they've got.
Knowing Kim would find a reason to stay, Garrett didn't wait around for her to argue. He shouldered his rifle and sprinted to the tower where he suspected Tripp had been when he'd taken out the gunman. As Garrett ran through the winding corridors of the plant, he couldn't help but think back on the urban warfare he'd experienced in the streets of Iraq, the reverberating rattle of full-auto rifles and the ricochet of bullets on concrete and steel. Lacey found the shadowy, dark corridors of the Carbon Black Plant's administration building oddly serene. With the battle raging outside, there was something about the muffled gunfire and damp, dewy chill within that felt like a safe haven, a place where everything might be okay. With light coming from the window, she could see the room they had ended up in very well. The dusty office that had once belonged to Vicky's father was like the Texas version of Mad Men, frozen in time. Its walls were covered in trophy buckhead mounts, exotics of every kind,
and about a million old photographs that hung wonky on the wall. Of all the many things on Lacey's mind, the last should have been nostalgia. But as much as she hated to admit it, Lacey understood Vicky's take on Sheriff Crowley. "He may be a crook, but he is my crook," she'd said. Lacey felt the same about the Kaisers. They were the devil you knew. Lacey moved to the window and peeked outside to find gunmen darting through the compound, taking cover, returning fire, and moving again. Vicky's inexplicable confidence was her only indication that the good guys would win. Lacey was beginning to wonder if she should drink the cocky Kaiser Kool-Aid when she saw a Talon gunman sprinting toward them. Smitty had expected the smoke to have cleared by now, but it was only getting worse. The grayish-brown plumes billowing over the cab had engulfed the dozer entirely. Keeping an eye on the temperature gauge, which had tilted into the red, he wondered how long it'd be before the engine would stop running, or worse yet, what would happen if fire reached the fuel tank. Trying not to panic, Smitty turned to Savannah and forced a smile. "Hanging in there, darling girl?" Savannah returned the gesture, which looked equally strained.
"Daddy, we gotta make it."
"Of course we are. We've just gotta get down the path a little, that's all." Smitty pointed to the windshield. "See how the wind's blowing the smoke? The direction it's moving?" Savannah looked to every window, as if really studying it.
"Going south to north, I think."
"And we're headed south, which means we'll get on the other side of this smoke real soon. Just looks bad because a fire line was moving toward us. We'll just be fine, though. You'll see."
"But we've been going for a long time."
Savannah turned to him, worry etched on her face.
"Why haven't we made it yet?"
"Damn good question." Smitty knew they'd never outrun the blaze, but if they could get upwind, they might have a chance. Of course, he also knew that a big fire like this one could spread, and there was a chance he was taking them from a bad spot to a worse one. To change the subject, he pulled out his phone and checked it. Although there was still no signal, Smitty handed it to Savannah. "Why don't you call your mom?" It was a suggestion Smitty had put off until now. First and foremost, he was almost certain there was still no service, but the last thing he wanted to do was worry Crystal. At the same time, there was a real possibility that this was the end, and if it was, then at least they'd tried. Savannah took the handoff and noticed what Smitty already had. There weren't any bars.
"Says no signal."
Smitty nodded, still looking forward.
"I know, baby, but just give it a shot, okay?"
He had no idea how cell phones worked, but thought that maybe even if the call didn't make it, Crystal's phone would register that they'd tried. So she'd at least know that they cared, and in their very last moments, they were thinking about her. As Savannah fiddled with the phone trying to get it to work, Smitty looked down at the temp gauge to find it was as deep as it could go into the red. He was trying to fight his own alarm when the engine stammered. Then the dozer went herky-jerky and died with a sudden jolt.
"Daddy!"
Startled, Savannah dropped the phone.
"What happened?"
Without the motor's rumble, the eerie crackle and hiss of flames filled the void. Smitty worked to get the dozer started, pleading under his breath.
"Come on, Big Yeller. Come on."
There was an electric hum when he turned the key, but nothing more. He tried again and again. Then it finally sputtered to life. Clamping his eyes shut and letting out a big exhale, Smitty shifted into gear. The dozer moved several feet, then locked up tight as the engine went silent. Repeating the starting procedure, Smitty urged the dozer into action, this time loudly.
"Come on, come on, you damn piece of crap! Come on!"
Smitty kept at it and kept at it, but no amount of verbal abuse would coax the big beast back into action. They had gone as far as they could go. The problem was that far as they could go wasn't near far enough. Fighting back tears, Smitty turned to his daughter, who was smart enough to figure that out.
"Let's give your mama a call."
Stifling a sob, Savannah nodded.
"Okay, Daddy."
Smitty pulled her close and gave her a hug, then reached to the floorboard to pick up the phone. After flipping it over and brushing the dust off the screen, he was shocked as hell to find the last thing in the world he'd expected. His check for a signal revealed one single bar. Smitty said a quick, desperate prayer and swiped the screen open for possibly the last call he'd ever make. 60.
Tripp ducked another hail of bullets that sparked the railing above his head and tried to make himself as small as possible. He threw his back against a piece of machinery, cooked hot by the menacing sun, and felt the immediate burn of iron on skin. Unable to sit tight another second, Tripp shifted his weight for a move when another think-think from the suppressed rifle at the doorway was supplanted by a single exploding bang. With the Bren silenced, Tripp leaned out to find Garrett in the doorway, standing over a dead body. Yanking a kerchief from his back pocket, Tripp wiped his brow.
What took you so long?
Garrett, still panting from the climb, just shook his head and smiled.
Too damn many stairs.
Tripp scrambled to his feet and peered over the side in search of the answer he'd been seeking since the gun battle started.
Who are these boys on our side?
Garrett moved up beside him.
No idea, but I'd say we're in a good spot to give them a hand.
He exchanged his Nighthawk for the Bren.
Bad guys are in uniform. Shoot at them. See any rednecks that look like us? Leave them be.
Tripp holstered his own SIG, picked up the TX-10, and made a sweep of the ground below with his scope. The outlaw operators, in boots, jeans, and Stetsons, were unleashing hell on the Talon guards. He took three quick shots at the silver-haired gunman, but missed.
Damn it.
Off target also, Garrett lowered his rifle.
Went into the main office.
Tripp put eyes on optics again to see if he could get another look.
He's the boss man?
Yep.
Garrett gave a nod.
Russian named Orlov.
Tripp couldn't believe what he'd heard.
Russian?
I'm going after him.
Tripp kept the crosshairs on the office door where Orlov disappeared in case he came back out.
Want me to go with you?
Nah, just give me a little cover fire to get across the courtyard.
Without another word, he bolted for the door, his boots clanging on the iron grating as he sprinted away. Ike turned to check on Sanchez for about the 50th time. As a little bird pilot with the Night Stalkers, he'd been more accustomed to doling out punishment than being on the receiving end. To think the deputy had made it through 4 overseas combat tours only to be KIA where he hailed from was a hard pill to swallow, especially knowing that he had a family waiting for him back at home. Planning to ignore whoever the hell was calling, Ike decided to make an exception when he saw it was Ray Smitty. Of course, he'd not told Asadi, but he'd pretty much given up hope. Snatching the phone from his console, Ike hit the Bluetooth to take the call through his headset.
Where are you at, Smitty?
There was dead air, some crackling, then Smitty's frantic voice.
Pray to God you're close, Ike.
Depends.
Ike couldn't help but smile.
Hope like hell you're not still on the coal place.
Right here in the middle of it, me and Savannah, about a half mile west of that canyon on the south end. We're in bad trouble. You gotta come for us.
You sure there ain't no other option?
Ike turned back to check on Sanchez.
See, I'm headed straight for the hospital and—
No, Smitty cried. There ain't no one else, man. You're it. You gotta help us.
Ike struggled with what to do. Sanchez looked bad. Death's door kind of bad. Going back now would almost certainly spell the end for him. But if he didn't go back, Smitty and his daughter would die an agonizing death. Ike knew exactly what Sanchez would want him to do, but that didn't make his decision any easier. He gritted his teeth and pushed the stick left, swinging his bird into a tight U-turn.
Hang tight, Smitty. Be there as soon as I can.
Asadi turned to Ike.
What you doing? We have go hospital.
I know, buddy, I know. We're headed there soon. But Ray and Savannah need our help. We can't leave them behind.
Savannah?
Asadi's face brightened.
She okay?
Ike nodded, not knowing if she would be when they got there.
That girl your friend?
She my best friend.
Asadi kept his eyes forward, head on a swivel, searching the smoke-filled horizon.
Going sit with me at lunch.
Given the desperation in Ray's voice, they were in immediate danger. But this was no swoop-in-and-out kind of rescue. It'd have to be done among the smoke and flames. Ike hated to imagine the gruesome carnage they might find. Asadi would never recover from it. It had been years since the Mogadishu disaster, but to Ike, it still felt like yesterday. He couldn't let this happen to Asadi this early on. Those nightmares were hard enough to bear as a grown man, much less a child. The boy had enough demons already. Smitty couldn't believe how fast the heat had overtaken the dozer.
Just minutes after the engine locked up and the air conditioner went off, it was nearly unbearable. Even without a raging wildfire, sitting inside the cab as they were with no ventilation beneath a blazing Texas sun was a sure heatstroke. He and Savannah were minutes away from suffocating. Smitty mustered up the calmest voice he could for a man surrounded by roaring flames.
Darling girl, we can't sit here any longer. We gotta get some air.
Savannah looked all around in panic, knowing what Smitty knew. The only thing between them and the fire was the cab of that dozer. She broke into sobs.
But where can we go?
Smitty pulled her into a tight embrace and kissed the top of her head.
Ike's coming for us. If we get on the roof, he'll see us better anyhow. We'll be all right. I promise.
How could he promise anything? Smitty looked around again, hoping for a break in the smoke, but it was only getting worse. Ike had said that he was close, but who really knew? He was probably just placating him, the way he had just done with Savannah. He grabbed her hand and stood, hunched over, his head beneath the roof. Turning to his daughter, he kissed her on the head again, trying to think of the right words, but coming up short. With nothing left to do, he took Savannah in his arms and lifted her up onto his chest. She wrapped her legs around his waist and buried her face in his neck. Smitty could feel the wetness of her tears on his collar. Spinning around, Smitty clicked the latch, kicked the door open with his boot, and immediately took the punch of heat and smoke. Savannah screamed at the fire's intensified crackling hiss, and Smitty couldn't say that he blamed her. It terrified him to his very core. What's worse, the smoke stung his eyes so fiercely, they instinctively clamped shut. Only able to force his right lid open a sliver, he stepped out onto the stairs and froze. Could he do this? Could he climb to the top by feel, holding on to his daughter for dear life? He turned back, contemplating a retreat. But that was only delaying the inevitable. If Ike came, they had to be up top. Smitty took a couple of steps onto the platform and felt the side of the cab. With Savannah's soft sobs his motivation, he grabbed hold of the roof, put his boots on the railing, and shimmied up and over the door to the top of the cab. To his relief, getting an extra 10 feet or so gave them a little more air, but his strength was giving out, and Smitty was unable to keep holding Savannah. After easing her onto the roof, she surveyed her surroundings, which Smitty already knew were no less terrifying than what they could see from the cab. Now, above the smoke, she could see the massive wall of flames heading right for them, and Ike was nowhere in sight.
61.
Ike tried a fourth call to Smitty, but got no answer. He hoped like hell it was lack of service and not the unthinkable, but as they flew over the area and saw the fire's destruction, reality set in. The earth was charred black, and everything that once stood in the fire's way, including homes, barns, and barbed wire fences, was all in smoldering heaps of ash and debris. It was as close a look at hell as Ike ever wanted. Asadi spoke over the intercom.
When we find them, poor kid had no idea this was turning from a rescue mission to a recovery operation.
Ike turned back to Sanchez, whose chest didn't move. If he was breathing at all, it was shallow. Ike couldn't bring himself to look Asadi in the eye.
Soon. Real soon.
If he was telling whoppers, might as well tell another good one.
Almost there, kid.
Having made a pass across the length of the firefront, Ike veered right, came back in, and swooped through the smoke. He kept a close eye on his instruments, notably the altimeter and attitude indicator, making sure they were level. He wouldn't be the first pilot to get disoriented and nosedive into the ground. Finding nothing but hazy skies, Ike pushed the stick left and circled wide for one last pass over the ranch. He was nearly out of the haze when the smoke parted between two fire lines, revealing a bright yellow flash. Ike tilted the stick right and looped back around. Unfortunately, he was too late. Whatever he thought he saw was engulfed again by the smoke. Afraid he'd pass it by again, Ike pulled the cyclic and slowed to a hover to get his bearings. Straining his eyes to see through the gray haze, he was startled by a sudden punch on the arm. He looked right to find Asadi hopping with excitement and back pointing in the opposite direction.
Look, look, over there.
Asadi's eyes were saucers.
See, over there.
Ike gave his bird a little right pedal, aimed at where Asadi was pointing, and pushed the stick forward. A few seconds into the cloudy abyss, and the smoke parted to reveal a big yellow dozer between the fire lines. Coming in closer for inspection, his rotor blades pushed away the smoke that had enveloped Smitty and Savannah, who were desperately trying to wave him down. Ike dropped the thrust as much as he could and swooped in and around, hovering just high enough to keep the thumping rotors at a safe distance, but low enough for father and daughter to leap from cab to cockpit. The tricky part was getting in close enough for them to jump, but not so close that it would blow them off the cab. Lowering the collective and nudging the cyclic left, Ike eased his bird to the dozer, lining up the backseat door as best as he could. The rotors had cleared out the smoke, but the damn blasting wind was bullying him off target. Hovering over inch by inch, Ike got so close that Smitty heaved his daughter into the back, where she landed with a thud. Ike gave it a little left pedal to even up and bumped the stick to get closer. Smitty had just reached for the door when a downdraft caught the bird and slammed his landing skid into the dozer's cab, knocking Smitty off his feet and rolling to the edge of the roof. The crunch of the collision activated the whoop, whoop, whoop of the ground proximity alarm, warning Ike of what he already knew. They were about to crash. He was fighting the stick and pedals to regain control when Smitty scrambled to his feet, bolted to the passenger door, and made a diving leap inside. Unable to hold his bird steady a second more, Ike yanked the collective, rocketing them off the ground, above the smoke, and high enough to figure out where the hell they were. With the Caprock escarpment running just north, he aimed toward Canadian and pushed the stick forward. Ike knew it was doubtful that Sanchez would make it back alive, but he'd have not died for nothing. The former Marine had spent a lifetime laying his life on the line, and this time he might have cashed it in. But if there was ever a picture worth dying for, it was the one in the back seat of a teary-eyed father embracing his little girl, the look on his face saying, "I'll never let go again." 62. As Garrett sprinted from the tower to the main office, two guards behind a Talon pickup popped out from behind and fired. The snap-snap of two near misses sent Garrett diving for cover, but there was none to be had. Rising to the prone position, he brought the red dot of his rifle to his right eye and swept the barrel back and forth in search of a target. Garrett flicked the selector to full auto and cut loose with everything he had. He'd spent nearly half a magazine before letting go of the trigger as two bodies hit the ground. One didn't move. The other dragged himself behind the truck. Scrambling to his feet, Garrett sprinted to the back bumper and eased past the tailgate. He'd just peered around the corner when a machine gun roared to life. The guard was ready, but his aim too hasty. Garrett emptied his gun before the shooter got off another round. With his ammo spent, Garrett tossed the rifle, yanked the Nighthawk from his waistband, and made for the front entrance of the main office where the Russian had disappeared. Knowing Orlov could be lurking inside the entryway, Garrett threw his back into the wall, gripped the pistol with both hands, and eased to the edge. A quick glance through the open door revealed only darkness, so Garrett bolted past it to the other side of the building. He suspected that the Russian might have reloaded, regrouped, and then snuck out the back door. But to his surprise, the only thing he saw was Sheriff Crowley's pickup, nestled in an alleyway close to the wall. Given the lawman's propensity for corruption, it shouldn't have been that big of a shock. Crowley had been running interference for Talon since the company arrived. Itching at the chance to deliver up a couple of well-deserved bullets for both parties, Garrett moved back to the entrance, checked around the doorframe, and snuck inside. Nighthawk leading the way. Garrett crept room to room, with only the scant bit of sunlight passing through bent Venetian blinds to guide his pathway. With the gunfight still raging, Garrett quickened his pace. But as he rounded the corner and entered the last office, he was shocked to find Orlov was using Lacey as a shield, his Gratch 9mm pistol pressed to her temple. Garrett drew a bead on Orlov's forehead. "Don't be stupid." He was about to pull the trigger when Orlov yanked Lacey's face in front of his own. "Why don't you let her go?" With a tilt of the head at the others, he added, "Them too, and it'll just be you and me." Orlov shifted Lacey again, their cheeks side by side. "Where's the fun in that?" Garrett kept his sights on Orlov, but just as soon as he thought he had an opening, the Russian would move, and the shot was lost. The risk too great,
He lowered the Nighthawk and held it by his side. I know for you, this is all a game. But take her from me and you take everything. That's the woman I love. Orlov loosened his stranglehold on Lacey, but kept her near, gun barrel still pressed to the side of her head.
Not so good at keeping your cards close, are you?
Garrett caught eyes with Lacey.
At some point, you just have to lay them on the table.
Even in the chaos of the moment, it wasn't lost on Garrett that he'd revealed the word she'd been waiting to hear. He didn't know what was to come, or if their future could even be measured beyond the next few seconds, but he wanted her to know the truth. He wanted Lacey to know that he loved her. Orlov's mouth flattened as he gave a slight nod.
Hand over the gun.
Garrett raised the Nighthawk slowly, turned the barrel into his hand, and held it out with the grip facing outward.
You can have it. Just let her go.
Orlov inched closer, eyes trained on Garrett's pistol. Suddenly, it looked as if he suspected a trap, and he halted mid-stride.
Why don't you come to me?
It was clear that Orlov was getting antsy. He unfurled his arm from beneath Lacey's neck, reached out, and gave the gimme here motion. Garrett took a couple steps and stopped, mentally willing Orlov to keep moving forward. A few more inches would put him in front of the window, where Tripp would have a shot.
You want it?
Garrett extended the pistol and waggled it at Orlov.
You can have it.
Losing patience, Orlov clutched Lacey and drew her back into the crook of his arm.
Time's up, Cole.
He mashed the barrel into her cheek.
Please.
Lacey's voice lulled to a whisper.
Please don't.
It ripped Garrett's heart out to see Lacey so vulnerable, so scared. But he knew Orlov would leave no witnesses. The second Garrett gave up his gun, they were all dead. Garrett pushed the air.
All right, take it easy.
He took three more steps, raised his right hand, palm out, and extended the Nighthawk with his left.
Just let her go.
In the last move he would ever make, Orlov reached for the gun. Were it not for the shattering glass of the side window, not a sound could be heard, not even from the rifle that fired a bullet into the Russian's brain. Lacey broke loose of Orlov as he collapsed and dashed to Garrett. He took her into his arms, squeezing with everything he had left. There was the temptation to latch on forever, but he had to get back out and end this thing once and for all. Garrett moved to the window to signal Tripp that they were all okay. But to his shock, it wasn't his buddy who had saved them, but an intrepid CIA operations officer who'd forsaken her own health to stay in the fight. Beaten, battered, and bloody, Kim Manning was standing outside, rifle still shouldered. It had been she who'd saved Lacey, and in truth, saved them all. Behind Kim were the flashing lights of a half dozen black and white SUVs with the gold state of Texas emblem on the side. Stetson-clad state troopers jumped out of their vehicles, M4 rifles at the ready, and dispersed, headed into battle against what little was left of Orlov's army. Garrett had a million questions, and hardly any answers. But before he could ask any of them, he had to hunt down Sheriff Crowley. Garrett had just made his move when the devil himself walked through the door. But even more surprising than that was that Crowley didn't look like a caged animal or a man on the run. The scumbag smiled wide, as if he owned West Texas and everyone in it. There was so much to unpack, Garrett didn't know where to begin. But none of that really mattered. Not the Kaisers, not Crowley, and not even the damned company that started the whole mess. Garrett's only concern now was his son. Asadi was his life, and anyone who threatened it better be prepared to lose their own. 63. Old Executive Office Building, Washington, D.C. Less than a month later, Kim sat in silence before the desk of the Deputy National Security Advisor, Connor Murray, waiting for the man she suspected would be delivering marching orders for her new job. Given the embarrassing revelation of Russian influence within the U.S. government, to include several members of Congress and high-ranking officials, there'd be calls for swift, but more importantly, discreet action to clean house. As the CIA operations officer personally responsible for killing Alexei Orlov, it was only natural that Kim would be tapped to run the counterintelligence task force that would hunt down the other rats involved, most of whom had scattered to the four corners of the earth. Her own boss, Bill Watson, was among the traitors,
and her primary target. Kim's first job was to assemble a unit of CIA ground branch paramilitary operators capable of the task. After Mario Contreras gladly accepted the assignment, she made a call to Texas. Few were more capable at tracking down people who didn't want to be found than Garrett Cole. When Murray breezed in, Kim recognized the look of a man faking nonchalance, pretending that what had happened with Orlov and the Russian connection to congressional leadership and governmental institutions was just one of those things that happens from time to time. The truth of the matter is that foreign infiltration does occur, but rarely is it as widespread. Aldrich Ames, Anna Montez, and Robert Hansen were villains of the worst kind who had inflicted major damage on the CIA, DIA, and FBI's reputations, not to mention the harm they'd done to national security. But wide-ranging conspiracy involving Talon Corporation and Russian intelligence was unprecedented. Murray took a seat behind his desk, gathered the loose papers on top, and compiled them into a single stack.
Sorry to keep you waiting, Kim. As you might imagine, things have been a bit crazy around here.
He looked up from his tidying.
CIA director has assured us that you understand what we need from your task force, but I still wanted to speak with you in person in order to emphasize the need for discretion here.
Kim smiled to keep things courteous.
I've been doing this job for a long time. Discretion is the name of the game. If you have something else in mind, then I suggest you spell it out.
Spelling it out is what I want to avoid.
Murray looked back at his stack of papers in hand, clacked the bottom edge on his desktop, and set it aside.
The idea is to keep this under the radar of the people manning the radar.
You want it off the books,
Kim said matter-of-factly. Murray winced, as if struggling to grab something at the far reaches of his mind.
I want you to use prudence and practicality to handle these situations on a case-by-case basis. After all, these are very dangerous people. Who knows how they might react once you find them?
Now Kim read him loud and clear. Her counterintelligence unit was really a hit squad. Rather than bring these traitors back for trial, it would be best if they just went off the radar. Because of Executive Order 12333 banning assassination, the CIA could not outright eliminate anyone. But if these individuals were to go down fighting, then that was another matter. Assassination was in the eye of the beholder.
Very well, then.
Kim gave a nod.
There's just one thing I'll need first.
Connor's eyes lit up.
I already told your director that money and resources are no object. This is the president's top priority. Everything in the U.S. arsenal is at your disposal.
If Kim was going to skirt the rules for Murray, she expected him to do the same.
Money and resources aren't the problem. It's a policy matter that's on my mind.
Policy?
Murray's brow furrowed.
I thought you understood that your team will have all the latitude it needs to—
Not related to this, Connor. Something else.
Before Murray could ask, she launched into her demand.
I want the Asadi Salim situation resolved, once and for all.
Connor leaned back in his chair and chuckled.
What does Asadi have to do with any of this? The kid survived, thank God. If he hadn't, we'd have a hell of a problem with his uncle. Bad enough we've delayed getting him home for as long as we have.
Asadi didn't just survive. He thrived. The kid risked his own life to save others. By any standard, he's a hero in every sense of the word. And Pakistan isn't his home. Texas is.
Murray leaned forward.
I can raise the issue, but—
Nope.
Kim shook her head.
There's no raising it. This is happening.
Murray wagged his finger.
Careful there, Kim. This is starting to sound a whole hell of a lot more like a demand than a request.
Connor, I don't know how you ever got the idea that this was a request.
Do you realize how important this deal is with Omar Zadran? This isn't just some political favor. This is a matter of national security. We need insight into what's going on in South Asia, and he is the one who can provide it.
I'm well aware of his access, and nobody wants him on our side more than I do. But not like this. Enough lives over there have been ruined without us adding another. I can handle Zadran.
Murray let out a frustrated sigh.
And if we don't go along?
Then me, Cole, and Contreras walk away.
Fine. Then we'll get someone else.
Okay.
Kim shrugged.
Try finding someone else with a personal stake in the game. Someone who's shed blood over this. Had their property destroyed. Had their loved ones savagely attacked. We're the only ones with a score to settle with the Russians. not to mention my old boss and your close friend, Bill Watson.
Kim let that sink in.
You really want discretion? Then we're the ones you want, not someone else.
Murray swiveled his chair, stared out the window.
The Afghan kid? You want to cash it all in for him? I shouldn't be telling you this, but you could make out like a bandit. Hell, you could probably have my job if you wanted it.
I don't want your job, Connor. I want Asadi fast-tracked to U.S. citizenship and the adoption process streamlined to make Garrett Cole's guardianship official. He's the boy's family now, and that needs to be over and done. No more uncertainty. Got it?
Murray swiveled back and stared her down.
Okay, we'll get it done.
Kim added with a raised index finger.
One more thing.
Asadi was your one more thing.
This still relates to him.
Murray's face was growing redder by the second.
Okay, what?
Asadi has an older brother, Faraz.
Murray furrowed his brow.
Thought he was killed when the Taliban raided their village.
Nobody knows about him, Kim admitted, but he was taken prisoner, and according to the latest intel, Faraz is still alive.
Murray looked puzzled.
What does this have to do with anything?
I want to go in and get him. Bring him back here and reunite the brothers.
And how do you expect to do that?
By getting Zadran to help broker the deal.
Murray burst into laughter.
You can't be serious.
Kim didn't blink.
I'm dead serious.
So where is Faraz now?
Kim took out the aerial photograph from her lock bag, laid it on the desk.
Right here. Tribal area. She pointed to a dot on the map and tapped it. Compound belonging to a warlord heroin trafficker in Afghanistan.
64.
Smitty couldn't believe his good fortune. Not only had he survived the wildfire and saved his daughter, but he'd also managed not to piss off Crystal in the process, which was a feat among feats that rivaled them all.
Of course, she'd been on cloud nine since they moved into the hunting lodge atop the Cap Rock on the Cole Ranch. She'd actually called it a dream come true. If she'd ever uttered those words in her life, Smitty hadn't heard them. It didn't matter that everything smelled like smoke. The place beat misery mobile like a drum. No nosy neighbors, no mangy dogs, just the quiet solitude and serenity of the prairie before them. To him and the girls, it was heaven on earth. Smitty took the handoff of a 2x4 from Crystal and laid it across his sawhorse.
Hadn't seen you this happy since we first got hitched. He turned and took her all in. Always figured you'd be partial to country life. Should have done this years ago.
Crystal gazed around at the beauty of the landscape. With the rainfall they'd had at the beginning of September, a few places that hadn't been scarred by the wildfire were green and flourishing.
It's not just the house, Ray. It's everything. New job, new sights and sounds, a whole new life.
Smitty took a quick measure with his tape and looked up at Crystal.
So you're liking it all right over at the cafe?
Tips aren't as good as Crippled Crow's, that's for sure. But I love the hours. And Lacey and her mom are good to work for. Good as Ike, I guess.
All wonderful news.
Smitty went to sawing. Hope things work out for me, too. Crystal moved to Smitty and rested her hand on his arm to stop him.
You okay?
We better get moving.
Smitty rested the saw on top of the 2x4 and looked up.
We were supposed to be over at Garrett's a half hour ago.
It's just down the road.
Crystal laughed.
Talk to me for a minute.
We are talking.
He gave her a wink to let her know he was kidding.
Has Garrett mentioned anything about working on the ranch?
Nah, and I didn't want to bring it up since he gave us a place to live.
Smitty took a sip of his pearl.
Not sure if he even knows what he's doing yet. Up in the air with his equipment all burnt to hell.
But Talon's gone for good, right? They're shutting down the mine?
Yep, they're done for.
Smitty laughed.
Uncle Sam was extra eager to move on from that mess. But it looks like your best friend Vicky is taking control of the old business. Worked out a deal with the feds to pay back all the money her family owed. So I guess a Kaiser will be back at the helm of Mescalero Exploration again.
Crystal chuckled.
Vicky ain't my best friend. Or a friend at all, for that matter. My guess is she wouldn't even wave if she saw me at the grocery store.
Well, I doubt Vicky Kaiser goes to the grocery store. Women like that have people for such lowly tasks.
Probably.
Crystal agreed.
But if she did, She wouldn't admit to knowing me. I can tell you that much.
Smitty hadn't revealed it, but Vicky had reached out to him about a job. Apparently, she was getting the old Mescalero crew back together and was looking for a few loyalists, some of whom were already on Crowley's unofficial payroll. Of course, none of them knew Smitty had been playing both sides of the law. What exactly Vicky wanted from him, he hadn't a clue, only that she promised monetarily it'd be well worth his while. But the thought of diving back into that world had no appeal. Of course, desperate times call for desperate measures, and with Talon gone and a Kaiser back in control of the Texas Panhandle, the offer was something he had to consider. Smitty smiled to let her know that he wasn't worried, even though he was.
Well, let's just hope Garrett needs me out here as a ranch hand. That'd make everything perfect.
Crystal got right in front of him, stepped onto her tippy toes, and gave him a peck on the lips.
Ranch hand or not, Ray, everything already is perfect.
She gave him a love tap on the rear.
Now, let's get going.
As Crystal went inside to change, Smitty took a sip of his beer and looked around, thinking how far he'd come. From crook to convict, then stoolie to solid citizen. He'd dreamed his whole life of living in a place like this, with a family he loved. And to keep from blowing it all, he had to stay clean. He had to be home, and he had to be a father. As Smitty turned to the open plains ahead and gazed out at the endless horizon, he prayed a simple prayer, hoping this time it'd stick. Please, dear Lord, don't let me screw this up. 65. Garrett stood rigid as oak, staring at the freshly turned soil of a newly dug grave. Since the fire on the ranch, the battle with Orlov, and everything else in between, his head swam as he mentally pieced his world back together. The Coles and Kaisers were no longer enemies, and a scumbag like Crowley was somehow a friend. Life was a lot simpler when he knew who to hate. Garrett had enough to take care of without contemplating old feuds, particularly what was taking place back at the house, not 30 yards behind him. They call it a celebration of life, but he'd never really bought into that nonsense as anything other than good marketing for folks like undertakers and condolence card companies, people who were in the business of selling death. The funeral was long over and done, and supposedly so was the mourning, but Garrett still felt low, and supposed he always would. When a loved one passes, a piece of you goes with them, and the reality was he'd never be whole again. Garrett was so engrossed in the memory of his mother that he hadn't heard Lacey walk up from behind. His sudden turn must have cued her into his surprise.
Oh, hey there, Lace.
Didn't mean to scare you. Just thought you might be hungry.
Lacey lowered a plate full of brisket, coleslaw, and potato salad. A big pile of bread and butter pickles rested atop the meat, along with Kate's famous barbecue sauce. Although it looked heaven sent, Garrett didn't have much of an appetite given what weighed on his mind. Garrett took the handoff anyhow. Think this'll hit the spot. He looked back at the house to see Asadi, Savannah, and the Sanchez kids chasing each other around the yard, while the adults sat at the picnic table and on lawn chairs in the shade on the porch. Butch and Ike were still at his smoker, basting a rack of ribs he'd put on for dinner. Like it or not, this celebration of life would continue into evening. Lacey took a seat on the concrete bench and patted the spot beside her.
Pull up a seat. Tell me what's going on in that head of yours.
Garrett did as he was ordered and dropped down beside her. Finding a flat spot to rest his shiner bock and the plate of food, he turned to Lacey. For some reason, in that very moment, he'd never found her more beautiful. As the soft breeze of a mild cold front blew in from the north, it whipped her hair ever so slightly. With the wide prairie and empty horizon behind her, it felt like they were the last two people on earth.
What's going on in my head?
Garrett only repeated the question to buy a little time to think. Where do I even start? Lacey leaned in and gave him a playful shoulder bump.
Start from the beginning.
Working undercover over the past few years, Garrett had grown used to keeping his feelings to himself, hiding anything that might be used against him or his family. While Alexei Orlov had been right in saying that working undercover was more who you are than what you do, that life had grown tiresome and lonely. Garrett didn't want to keep secrets from Lacey anymore. He wanted a best friend. He wanted a partner. And he wanted to be free. Garrett gave her a playful bump right back.
The beginning, huh? He shook his head. I think that's just it, Lacey. I don't know where my old life ended and my new one began.
Well, let's start with something easy then.
With that throaty voice, the one that was like music to his ears, Lacey made it easy for him. She knew where to begin, even when he didn't.
What do you think about this very spot where we're sitting? The headstone, the new trees?
Garrett smiled. I love it. Didn't think I would, but I do. His mother's new gravesite had potential. More than potential. It'd be beautiful one day. When neighbors got wind of everything that had happened out at the ranch, there'd been an outpouring of support. They'd moved her casket from the location Talon had destroyed to up by the house. They'd planted a grove of trees and trenched a water line from the barn so it would always be green. And most importantly, Butch wouldn't have far to travel for his daily visits. It was well beyond a tribute to his mother, the hero nurse, loved by all. It was a tribute to the hearts and souls of the people who called the Texas High Plains their home. It was a tribute to all his neighbors, even the ones who lived over 20 miles away. Whether they knew him personally or not, these people were more than a community. They were a family. Lacey gently draped her arm over his neck.
Okay, that's a step in the right direction. So what about the rest of the ranch? Think you can start over?
For Garrett, that was a tougher question. There wasn't much Talon hadn't destroyed in the dig, or the fire hadn't ravaged. His home and the horse barn were left untouched by the grace of God, and the cattle and horses were saved. But his alfalfa fields, hay equipment, and tractors were all consumed in the blaze. And worse yet, his center pivot irrigation system was a twisted pile of melted junk. Without it, Garrett didn't know what would save the ranch.
Insurance will cover most of the damage, but it's not enough to replace everything. It'll get me out of debt, and that's about all. Starting over wouldn't be easy.
No.
Lacey pursed her lips.
No, it wouldn't.
Garrett scanned the horizon, beyond the destruction to the natural beauty of the sunset, with every shade of red, orange, and yellow. God had gone and outdone himself again.
But I love this place.
He looked her in the eye. And I'd love someone to share it with. Given yet another cryptic revelation about their future, Garrett had half expected Lacey to call him out for another non-plan or to launch into him for giving up. Because giving up on the ranch was giving up on her, too. But she was nothing but smiles in her response.
Garrett, you're right about one thing. Starting over won't be easy, or cheap, or maybe even smart. But when it comes to love, you never want to leave anything on the table.
As if on cue, Asadi came running up to him with his new best friend Savannah trailing close behind. They were all giggles and grins.
We gone do horseshoes. You want play?
Asadi thumbed back at his lunch buddy, who'd worn a permanent grin since he moved to the ranch.
We beat you good.
Garrett turned to the horseshoe pit to find his jarhead buddy, too stubborn to die, banging away at an iron stake.
Damn it, Tony. Doctor said you're supposed to take it easy. I'll do that.
As Sanchez shrugged in reply and went back to hammering, Garrett scanned the scene around his house in the backyard. Between Bridger and his family, the Sanchez brood, Lacey's kids, and a whole host of friends, neighbors, and folks he didn't even know, Garrett found that right place Lacey was talking about. Somehow, the churned earth and charred ground seemed to matter less, and the smiles and laughter meant a whole lot more. Garrett looked back to Asadi and playfully cocked an eyebrow.
Think you can beat me at horseshoes, huh? Them sounds like fighting words, outlaw.
He turned to Lacey and took her by the hand.
What do you say? Up for the challenge?
Lacey stood, gazed out at the pasture, then leaned down and whispered,
I'm up for anything you can throw at me, Garrett Cole.
As Lacey turned and walked away with Asadi and Savannah on each side, she pulled them in close as they marched to Sanchez, talking trash about horseshoes the whole way over. Garrett didn't know exactly what was said, only that it got a big reaction. The deputy flexed like the Incredible Hulk, let out a deep growl, and chased Asadi and Savannah around the yard. It was with that scene and those parting words that Garrett knew he was there to stay. It wouldn't be easy, it wouldn't be cheap, and it probably wouldn't be smart. But it was home, and if Lacey was up for anything, then he was too. Given his latest phone call from his good friend at the CIA, everyone in Garrett's world would certainly be put to the test. The war hadn't ended with the death of Alexei Orlov. It had only just begun. This is Jeremy Arthur. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Firestorm, a novel by Taylor Moore, presented by William Morrow and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media, executive producer Suzanne Franco Mitchell. Text copyright 2022 by Robert Taylor Moore. Production copyright 2022 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.